Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program titled Freckles Think Peace Pieces, Police-Community Relations, A Search for Common Ground. Our speaker is former Justice Department official Edward D. McClure. We begin with an introduction by Linda Haywood, Director of Boston University's African American Studies Program.
Born into a large, loving, deeply spiritual family in Bed-Stuy, New York, Edward D. McClure learned the rules of the street, the moral structure of the black church, and viewed white privilege from his shoeshine box at Yale University. He then melded the diversity of these experiences into a philosophy that has sustained him as a cultural analyst, negotiator, and bridge builder through many decades of personal and professional achievements, including 25 years as a community relations officer with the U.S. Department of Justice Community Relations Service, CRS. Mr. McClure's nature-centric philosophy that diversity is normal supports its commitment to equal protection under the law as guaranteed by the 14th Amendment and subsequent civil rights laws. During his years with CRS, Mr. McClure consistently brought the streets and the halls of power together to address police-community relations conflict, as well as issues arising from court-ordered school desegregation, Indian land claims, Ku Klux Klan rallies, and immigration. In all of his work, his strategy has been to create an atmosphere of trust, a climate for genuine dialogue and communication, and institutional support to fulfill constitutional and statutory obligations through written and enforced civil rights conflict management policies. Mr. McClure is the author of We Love You, Mama, which celebrates Mother's Day every day, Freckles, which raises the question of why nature created humans in an array of colors, and Police-Community Relations, which illuminates the importance of creating an atmosphere of mutual respect and fostering open and honest dialogue. From 1976 up to his retirement from the U.S. Department of Justice in 1993, Mr. McClure developed the Freckles multiracial model of the language of confrontation and conciliation, which is based on a philosophy of inclusion rather than exclusion, and has tailored the model to meet varied institutional needs. He continues to write and produce print and video materials on civil rights, conflict management, race relations, and multiculturalism. It's my great honor to introduce to you, Mr. McClure.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, and I'm sort of happy to be here, but I'm not an academic. I'm from the University of the Streets, really, and I'm dressed up today so that I can mediate my being here. I think that the thing is that, to me, what I had to do was develop a concept for the street, because I was brought up in a church. And so my mother used to tell me, she'd say, if you fight or if you go out there and get in trouble, I'm going to beat you. She said, turn the other cheek. The Bible says such and such and such. So I turned the other cheek, and they smacked me. I turned the other cheek, and they smacked me. And then I said, Mom, look, this is not. She said, you go ahead back out there, and then they kicked me. So I said, Mom, you're going to have to beat me. And that's when I ran into trouble in terms of conflict, how to deal with conflict. I ran into trouble because I was telling myself that the Bible said to love thy neighbor, kiss thy brother, hold thy sister, and I'm going out in the street, And here I'm getting bombarded with all kinds of obstacles that seem foreign to me and to the philosophy my mother was teaching me. So I had a problem. And the point is that what we're getting at is that the fact that all of us have problems and have conflicts with some of the things that we learn and then some of the things we have to practice. So that I was really in a trouble, but the point is that's what the Police Community Relations Service, the Department of Justice, does, deals with conflicts. And those conflicts, some of them are pretty heavy. Later on, I got a copy of a case I dealt with in the city of Lawrence where there was a riot, but we'll talk about that later, but I want to kind of let you know. But to begin with, the philosophy that I use, nobody else uses it, I guess, Freckles, is that it starts with someone drew a circle to keep me out, and I drew a circle to include us both, which, again, is conflict. Now, how are they going to keep me out? And especially when the civil rights legislation, the United States Code 942, whatever it is, said that all people are born equal, they're all equal rights, and so forth and so on. So what I'm saying, we have the kind of teaching my mother did, running in conflict and supporting the Constitution, but running in conflict with the code of the United States government. So that I was in a big problem. So the philosophy I had to develop was that nature's the boss. Nature's the boss for me, not for you, but for me. And the conflict I saw was that man was trying to reprogram nature to fit his particular things. And I found this, I don't want to go off too far, but I found this in the nursery rhymes that I was being taught. I was a little young man, and I remember reading about Robin Hood, and it said you're supposed to steal from the rich and give to the poor. And I thought of my mother. And I said, steal from the rich and give to the poor. Is stealing wrong? And is it eradicated by the fact if you give it to the poor? And how do I know you're giving it to the poor? Who are you giving it to? So that I had this conflict with my early socialization, if you want to put it. There was another one, Red Riding Hood. The story goes that when Red Riding Hood went down the road there, she would find Grandma or somebody that would be compassionate and share intimacy with her. But the point was that when she went down there, who's she find? The wolf. And so many people today are finding the wolf. And it's a big, big, big problem. And subsequently, some of them get into a conflict that leads to violence. So that one of the things about the philosophy is that nature's the boss. And everybody, Martin Luther King said that man-made laws must square with the laws of nature. That's what Martin Luther King said. So that the problem is that man thinks that because science, he discovered science, that, you know, he's on an equal basis with man to determine what the nature of the universe is or what the nature of I am as a human being or you are as a human being. And I follow that along with, these are think pieces that I'm talking about. These are think pieces. They're not scientific facts. They're not inscrutable facts. I don't go along with them. Because the point is that I think what we have to do sometime, I mean, the things I had to do when I worked with justice, I don't know there wasn't any answer until I got there. In other words, it wasn't pre-planned based on Malthus theory or Freudian theory or anybody's theory. It was what I found there. So what happened to me in those kind of situations, too, I brought in some of the thinking of soul food. In other words, you take what you got and you create a beautiful mosaic out of it, one that you can utilize to negotiate your way through the problems. Also, in this concept that I use, nature-centric and man-centric, is this conflict of who's the boss, and I see it as in terms of I and we. Nature is the boss of the universe, man is the boss of maybe Times Square, but he acts like he runs the whole thing, or like he's the boss. He doesn't have to subjugate himself to the laws of nature like everybody else. That's why the problem that we have, I have anyway, with civil rights and government policies, is that what we do, we have policies that, there are policies that say the policy for you is one thing and the policy for me is another thing. For example, today I was in the park up there, and I got in a little talk with somebody who was not supposed to ride bicycles in the park. And they said that, well, they didn't see any sign. They didn't see a sign. Well, I said, there's a sign at the other end of the park. There's a sign over there. But then it occurred to me that the administration had set it up so that the people that live there, they can all say, I didn't know. But they tell them to use that entrance because there's no sign there. That's what happens in law enforcement. Selective law enforcement. For example, if you happen to be maybe blonde hair, blue eyes, or if you happen to be fine or whatever else, there's three responses you can get. One is a warning, citation, or the other one is we can keep you overnight. But it all depends. And one of the biggest problems we have is law enforcement, is that selective law enforcement. You can't trust everybody. But yet still, Mama's telling me you got to trust everybody. And I say, what is the point at which I say I'm not going to trust you? What is it? Do I have to be, hit over the head or something like that, or be given a beating before I realized what to do? So that when I went to work for the Justice Department, they asked me, somebody told them that they wanted somebody that could stand on their own two feet, handle themselves, and be creative in responding to situations. And for some reason or other, several people told them to get in touch with me. I would be the man for the job. But I don't know where they got that idea from. But I didn't feel, threatened or intimidated, because when I was young, growing up in Brooklyn, I had to protect myself. I had to survive because I was the oldest boy. And everything that came down, I'm going to get my brother. My brother will take care of my brother. Beat up. My brother got beat up so many times. I got beat up so many times trying to play that role. But the thing is that the selective law enforcement is the problem in policing. And the selective law enforcement, the implication is that you won't get equal treatment. Because now I have a wife. You can see that she's interracial, but she can go into some place and they'll ask her for identification, and she might give them a slip of paper or something, say, I've been here before, and they might go. But I go in there, and they want three or four different identifications until I show them my Justice Department identification. Then it's, sir, what would you like? Can I help you? But it shouldn't be like that. It should not be like that. But then what happens when you do that, somebody gets angry and somebody starts calling maybe the police some kind of names and all kind of reactions, and the next thing you know, it's the use of the gun or the club or something to deal with that person, because there's an absence of interpersonal skills or the ability to communicate with the person as a human being. So I asked some of them, I said, is that the way you arrest your mother? And some of them would say, what do you mean? What do you mean? They say, well, you broke the law and such and such and such. But this whole problem, I'm telling you, is unbelievable. And that's why I think today is this ability to trust the police. Not that the police are all bad. Now, wait a minute. I don't want you to get that. But like, for example, let me give you another example of another police officer. This was a black police officer, and I said to him, why are you beating up your own people like that? He said, we're brothers in blue. And what does that mean? The brothers in blue supersede the Constitution, the statutory obligation that you have as a police officer? But again, the politics, the selective enforcement, and the politics and all of that force him to not even acknowledge his own people, his own children, or anybody else. we're brothers in blue, therefore we have to go along with what the union and what some of the others say. And it's not a negative thing. It's a thing where they make you an offer you can't refuse. That's what happens a lot of times. And the thing is that what I'm thinking of is that a lot of that started, this whole business of you have no choice, you have no voice, you have nothing to say. And all you have to do is pick up the papers today and you look at what happened in Egypt, what happened in Syria, what's happening around the world is the people have no choice, they say. This is what they're saying. In other words, it's like taxation without representation when we first started this country with England. But around the world, we've got the same problem of you don't respect us. We're not human beings. In fact, when they made the laws, I read somewhere where about 30% of the population made the laws for 100% compliance. And so it's extremely, extremely difficult. But now we're getting to the point where, you know, it's big time wars and the violence that we have to contend with. So my feeling is even more so what Mama said to me is even more important today to learn how to negotiate, to learn how to live together. And I think young people better pay attention because you can't go and talk to some of them and tell them that they're wrong or they're this or that. And all you got to do is read some of the stories from some of these countries where young people decided to protest and go and sit, and a number of people just get killed. They shoot them. And that's why the dictators, to some of them, in my opinion, that's why they had to go. Because the thing that triggers a lot of violence is when you start shooting your own people, you start killing your own people. And even in the civil rights thing, I understand from a lot of police that the thing that really turned it loose and turned it to a point where it was protests and real violence was the fact, Kent State College, that the first time they shot somebody up there at Kent State. And the point is, that's what really triggered it off. So when you start killing your own people, the leadership or the dictator's got to go. Now, people say, well, that can't happen here. I saw this happen in the 60s. Well, when I went to work for justice in Sydney, that's how it started, little bit by little bit. And nobody paid attention. People wanted to talk about it. They didn't want to talk about it. Nobody wanted to talk about it until a brick went through the window. And when the brick went through the window, they said, why did they do that? Why did they do that? And they were so upset and hurt. And voted for affirmative action. I voted for this. I voted for that. Why did they do that? So today I'm just saying that we need to work out and teach students how to negotiate police-community relations so that there's a common ground. There's two sides of the coin. That's what I say. There's common ground. And you have to get that balance between what you want, what I want, and what we need. Now, to get that balance, that's why I use nature-centric, because there's one theme in nature is balance. Now, if you breathe in and you don't bring what? Out, what happens? The masquerade's over, right? The masquerade is over if you don't. All right, the tide comes in, and what? And the tide goes out. And the point is that if you play, anything has this element of nature that there's got to be a balance. We have summer, we have winter, all of these things, which, as Martin Luther King says, that man-made laws have to start with the laws of nature. That's all. And the laws of nature, nature's the boss. For example, like I hear people talk about, I'm a self-made man. And the truth is that somebody had to do something and negotiate with nature to even bring in this world. But we keep on with this thing of using social phenomena, social issues, to identify ourselves. That is why being black is not important, because that's not, shall we say, in good standing in the scheme that we use, in other words, to identify who is important and who isn't important. And the other thing that fascinates me, I'm trying to bring in so many things, but I can't get them all. But the other thing that fascinates me about this whole thing is that do you realize that the skin lightener business is one of the biggest businesses in the world? You know that, right? You aware of that? Okay. And even the skin, tan and all of that, but all of that business, not all that business is creates factories, manufacturing, this, everything to get away from what it was like when man first hit the continent. When man came in, black was an asset because it could negotiate the climate, the ultraviolet rays. It could go out and harvest food, do everything. So that what I'm saying, we need to get a balance between ebony and ivory. We need to put them two together. And with nature, that's what it is. It's always balancing. It's always balancing. And that's why my model, to me, is try to understand more the laws of nature. Not necessarily the laws of man, because some of that is self-interest. I think people talk to me about religion. I say that every religion had a prophet, and the prophet went to the Great Spirit and asked the Great Spirit, what is it all about? And the prophet got the message from the Great Spirit. But on his way back, he might have stopped for a beer or something and changed things a little bit, and he took it back to his group. And that's why your group is not as good as my group. I'm the one that's the real, true believer. But all of these things that happen in terms of trying to reprogram nature, exploit nature, and use nature, because there's a downside of everything in nature, everything. There's a downside. It's just like medicine. You take medicine, but I'm sick and tired of taking medicine. It helps one thing, but it creates something else for me. I can't deal with it. So that this whole thing of a balance is very, very, very important. And it's the two sides of the coin that you have to start with. It's like music. How many of you know music? For in music, for example, you might have the improvisario, the improvisationist, and the ensemble. But they go together. You know, but the improvisationist will act like, you know, in a world by themselves, but without the ensemble, they can't do anything. And I think so it is with all of us. So that's why I try to respect everybody. For better or for worse or whatever they are or whatever they can do, I try to respect them. And it is with my work with police community relations. I go into places where I say only a mother's love would go there. Some of the places that I've gone, I've seen some of them. I've worked on the Indian land claims. And you will go back in the woods where some of those people live. And it made me sick. And I was an officer. So I got home, and what did I do? I told my wife to pack up some clothes and stuff, and we shipped them up there. But the thing is that some of the things that you see, in other words, it angers you. It makes you angry. But again, my mother keeps me from getting in fights and getting in trouble and everything. But she said, you know, don't fight. God will take care of it. That's what she tells me. But I got to the point where I said, hey, something else is going to take care of them if they don't bother me. Stop bothering me. And, for example, when I moved right here to this town 42 years ago, boy, they sent a message that they didn't want me here. They sent a message. They sent a big message, a good message. But, again, it was my mother's faith and my mother's belief in the fact that things will change. Something will change. The spirit. And certainly they did over the years. But now, I want to say that I just want to give you a definition here of, just quickly, what the Community Relations Service is and what it does. The Community Relations Service is a department's peacemaker of color and national order, created by the Civil Rights of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and only federal agency dedicated to assist states and local units of government, private and public organizations, and community groups with preventing and resolving racial and ethnic tensions, incidents, civil disorders, and so forth. It's mutual understandings and agreements as alternatives, coercion, violence, litigation. Also, it assists communities in developing local mechanisms, conducting training, and other proactive measures to prevent and reduce racial and ethnic tension. As CRS, the Community Relations Service, it is not the only party, is interested party of conflicts. The agency is able to effectively apply its skills and training. Well, this is what I had to do for 30 years. But you know what? I just want to say this, too. I never got a promotion in 30 years. Never. And part of it was because I went by the law instead of by the politics. So I couldn't, I didn't ever get a promotion. But the point is, it's because my mother said, somebody will take care of it. The Great Spirit will take care of it. And so what I did was, I have been paid thousands of times by the people that I've provided service to. And as I said in the book, you'll see some of the letters and some of the things from people who greatly appreciate it. I'm talking about some heads of the agencies, some people in the FBI, different things. But that was my role. That was the role I enjoyed. I didn't want to be on the marquee. See, I wanted to be a diamond in the rough. That's what I wanted. I want to stay that way. I don't want to be polished up. No, I didn't. But the thing is that also one of the things was that I also ran into was that I remember some people telling me that if you help me to fire so-and-so, if you help me to fire so-and-so, we'll promote you and make you head of something. I said, I ain't going for the deal. I'm not going for the deal. But there's all kind of politics being played, all kind of politics that are being played. It was not that the job was the worst or the most trouble, but it's the people the people that you had to deal with. They would not work together. They would not put the people or the citizens before their responsibility. So fortunately enough, I found some people like myself who had the same principles over the years, and together they pulled me through and I pulled them through. We stuck together, but we were a minority. And I'm saying that minority is what it's all about, is strengthening that minority, getting more people through the schools and different places to teach them that they have to, we're not going to survive, in other words, by ourselves. It's only going to happen if we do it together. For example, when I moved to a city over there, this little young girl asked me, why was I so black? Why was I so dark? And usually I'd tell her to go to hell, you know. But she was so sweet. She was so sincere. And it was just dripping on her how honest she was, asking an honest question. An honest question. And there were some other people that were over there that were like, wasn't black. And they were, how dare she ask that question to, somebody like me? So I went to the little girl, and then she came over, and she jumped up on my lap, and she looked at me right in the eye. But the fact is, she had blue eyes, I had brown eyes. She had blonde hair, I had black hair. She had light skin. I had the dark skin. Look at me right in the eye. You know how, I don't know if you ever woke up sometime and there's a cat on the pillow. And you say, it scared the heck out of me. But anyway, she looked at me and she said, she was waiting for an answer. So me, I'm thinking of my mother, my nature-centric peace. And I said, come here. I said, what color is that flower? She said, red. I said, yeah. I said, well, what color is that one? She said, yellow. And I said, no, there's another one out there, the people of all colors. I said, where do you think those flowers came from? She said, God made them. I said, well, God made them. If God made them, and then God made people of different colors. But the point is, what I wanted to do was answer that question. So if somebody asks you, why are you so white? You can answer the same way. But this selective answering, the selective, a special way to answer to you, a special way to me, that's what's confusing our kids. And the other thing I want to add, too, while I'm here, was some of those kids grew up to be police officers. And some of them grew up to be police officers and told me they were the best police officers that I know. But some of them told me, thanks for being like a father to us. We had no father. He wasn't available. And those same police officers now, if they see me, they will come by sometimes. Some of them come up to me. I'm 80 years old now. Come up to me and give me a hug and give me a kiss. Now, these are not blacks. And the point is that right now, in my neighborhood, they've named me, well, they give me one of my names is Brother Fudge. But another name, they call me the Dusted Irishman. The Dusted Irishman. Which I think of it as a term of endearment. And, you know, I'm one of them. But I'm a little dusted, but, you know. But there's a lot of love out there, you understand? There's a lot of love out there, a lot of different kind of love out there. So what I'm saying, the advantage of that kind of police-community relations is important to what it does to the whole neighborhood. And another thing that impressed me, I was told my wife that Halloween, and everybody came around to pick up candy, but I let my wife go because, you know, if they saw me, I might scare them. So I wasn't in good standing, I felt. So anyway, they came to get their candy, and then I said, what am I doing? I said, I'm going out there. They're going to have to face me sometime. And I walked outside, and this little kid, 7, 8 years old, said, Mommy, 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 there's my friend's friend. He's my friend's friend. Talking about me. And I felt vindicated with the whole group. The whole adults, parents, and all of them. They start smiling and, you know, a change of scene. But what a little child can do. And it reminds me of a Turkish proverb that says, if you want to learn something, listen to the children. Community relations, again, for me. Also, when people came to my house, I didn't know what they wanted to come to my house for anyway, because I wasn't particularly happy about the relationship with them. But they come to my house, and somebody would come to the house, and the children, and they'd say, well, I brought you some candy. I brought this, that. Kids would sit as far away as they could from them. Some other people would come in the house, and they'd be sitting on top of them. The kids would be sitting on top of them. So I said to myself, again, that whole thing of listen to the children or watch the children, because there's a message there. It's like some of those messages are not a message in the terms of, you know, academic scholarship only or in the way we would say it. But the thing is that everybody communicate. All behavior is purposeful. Because you don't know what it is at the time, it doesn't mean it doesn't have a purpose. It's just like when my mother and I used to go to church all the time. I said, what the hell, I don't go to church all the time. 6 days a week or something. Man. See, we were holy rollers, as they call it, the Pentecostal types, you know. But my mother and them wanted to go to church all the time. I said, well, I don't want to. But you know something? I'm glad I didn't reject what they told. I didn't believe it. But I'm glad I didn't reject what they said, because today, because of today, that was the foundation of my career today, of the respect for people, all kind of people, that came out of that holy roller thing, people that were considered rejects and so forth. But at the same time, I was fortunate enough to shine shoes at Yale because we were on welfare. And at Yale, I got me an education. I considered myself a student without a portfolio. And to show you what happens if you have faith and you keep on going, because of that, they wanted to send me to Yale, pay my way. The people that I used to shine shoes for. Secondly, when I bought my house in the neighborhood, they didn't want to give me a mortgage. They didn't want me in there. I called one of those shoe shine customers. And the next morning, he called my wife and said, it's done. Come on down. But I'm talking about the faith and the hope and the courage and so forth that you have that my mother taught me, but I didn't believe her. But like the prophet, you know, I don't believe the prophet, but I got to try it out myself. I got to try to see if it works. And I was so happy about all the experiences that I've had, like the experience of even being here today. This is not my regular stomping ground. My stomping ground is sitting in the park up there where I live, or hanging out at the jazz club, or what else do I do? I do a lot of those things. I'm not, in other words, my school, my university is in the streets. Somebody else is in academia. But I know I have to hold hands with them. We have to hold hands together. In other words, to achieve anything, because there's two sides of a coin, breathing in and out. You can't do one without the other. You can't have a life without the other. And people ask me why I go there. I say, I'm going to see my psychiatrist up to the park. They say, you're crazy. I said, no. I'm communing with nature. But the thing is that all of these things going into helping me to develop a philosophy, nature-centric philosophy, that nature's my boss. Like I tell people, I tell them, I don't own my house. I don't own my own house. They say, what are you talking about? I said, I rent from nature. And they say, you're crazy. I said, did you read the paper the other day where somebody, some spirit greater than man came along and wiped his house away and sent it into the sea? Like nature says, don't build too close to the water, and the water comes and takes your house away. Well, to me, somebody said, what a disaster. I say, no. It's just nature yawning a little bit. Nature told you don't do that. But now somebody will say, well, this guy is he's a little way out there on this thing. But the point is, my philosophy is balanced. I can be gentle as a lamb, but also like I can rise up and be like a tiger. And I learned that from being in the service, the military, and the other from my mother, and I put the two together. And who would say that they would be a likely couple, those two? It's just like with our family, we all have a name from the Bible. Every one of us has one that has a name. And like my son, I gave him a nickname of Turtle, taken from the animals, the characteristics. And now he's a PhD. In other words, at the University of Wisconsin on the faculty. My daughter, I call her Lovey, though, because she's a loving child. But like I call her Little Lovey, like I call my wife Bird, because she's like a bird. She's always doing, she can't sit and do anything. So what I'm saying, I just keep this concept of nature-centric around me. And I reach out, and as I do it, I understand more and more about some of the patterns of behavior, that we're so much like them, like the animals that we see, the birds and everything else. But I would like to, I worked on a case, there was a riot in Lawrence, Massachusetts, 700 protesters. Oh, no. Oh, that's not the one. Oh, here it is, over here. But 700 protesters and all that kind of thing. But the point was, they put a curfew on the city. We had to put the curfew on the city. I helped them do that. And so forth and so on. It was a conflict between the Hispanic community. And at that time, what happened, there was a lot of immigrants and so forth in Lawrence, Massachusetts coming in. But at the same time, it was a conflict between the Franco-Americans and the Hispanics. Now, the Franco-Americans were long-standing people that lived there a long time. And the Hispanics came in, and subsequently, it's like everything else, you know, it kicked off a whole lot of problems. But the point was, I just want to emphasize that for you, was that the police were very involved in it, and they were trying to resolve the friction, the conflict, and everything else. And so finally, somebody said, the police are the problem. The police are the problem. So one of the congressmen came along, to, it was his district, and we were talking, and he said to me, come on, Ed. He said, we got to go out. So I took him out in the community where there were riots and stuff was. And he said, we got to go and put a plan together to deal with this congressman. So what we did was that I had made contacts. That's part of my job the night before, the day before. But I had made contacts. So what we did was we got 15 people, Franco-Americans, 15 Hispanics, and I suggested that the police, be pulled back, and they would patrol the area, the 15 each, to control the area. And the 15 controlled the area, and the police pulled back. And out of control in the area, that was the beginning of them working together, beginning to work together. And from there, I helped them move it to the street, to the mayor's office where it belonged in the first place. But the point is that I think that one of the things was important was that I heard that they found a lot of stuff. When the local police started patrolling and policing, they found a lot of stuff that they would never have found, maybe, if they hadn't involved them. But I'm saying involving the community relations. But they couldn't do it because they didn't have the previous relationship. Police-community relations involves not just the day of the raid or whatever it is. It involves a way of living in a community with other people. That's what it involves. So that's why I say yesterday is today and tomorrow. You know, it may not be today, but, you know, that song says, our turn will come. Our turn will come. We'll have everything. So the main thing that my contribution was to get out there and come up with a plan of action and bring all the parties together and so we could get on with it. But we did that, and then I left it up to the mayor and the rest of them to do what they're supposed to do, to resolve the conflict. But this is the kind of thing that hostage training, I was involved in some of that, and all of that stuff, it's a relationship. It's how you treat people. And if you don't know how to talk to people, you're going to need a stick or a gun. And you're going to need it if you don't know how to talk to people. And this is what happens. The premature use of force causes a tremendous problem and tremendous damage. I think the biggest thing is this cost. You don't realize the millions and dollars of money that's spent on these cases of premature use of force. You don't realize it. You're talking about the taxes and the cost of this and the cost of that. That's why it's important to have police-community relations, so you can reduce some of that and capture some of that money and put it into working with community groups and everything else that's necessary. I was the deputy director of the city of Springfield for the poverty program, and that was my specialty. I emphasized community relations, working with the community, working with the police, and working with... But it's not only the police. That's the problem, because a lot of times we say the police, but somebody's programming the police. It's just like the computer sometime. It tells you you owe some money, and you got a receipt from someplace else that said you don't owe it. And they say the computer said so. Somebody's programming the computer. And the thing is that I think that in myself that there should be more done, because if there's a problem, everybody's involved. I think the scientists, don't, you got to stop. We got to get Black History and something to get involved with those scientists. They're coming up with stuff you talk about will chain you. They're coming up with all kind of medicine, medication. They're coming up with... Now the black holes. Well, I don't want to get into that. I mean, I
think what we would like to ask you is to, in fact, tell us exactly what you were doing when you went to the Indian community And when you went to, how is this different from the other communities that you worked with over the years?
The land was taken away from them. They were treated like dirt. And the thing was, it wasn't until they filed the land claim, what I understood later on, that Tom Tureen helped them, but also that they found, they went to England or somebody else, and they contacted King George's office or whatever it is, what he is stuff, and they found somebody to dig in there and get the piece of paper, whatever it was, the legal thing that they needed to file a land claim. And then when we went up there too, was to decide when it went to be adjudicated, we had to go up there to decide whether it was going to be violence or not, because you know the thing was that all that land that they were claiming, you know, the people up there. But what I found out when I went up there was that a lot of the people were glad they filed a claim, and they were hoping that the Indians won, because they said maybe we'll get jobs. Because the point is, under the old situation, the people who controlled a lot of that land was the, trying to name it a company. But anyway, the company had Canadian Scuffers, Canadian Railroad, Canadian Oil, they had and some one other thing. But they controlled all of that. And they were taking the land from there and keeping their land there and everything else. But they were using all those other people, but not the local people. And that's what the local people said, I hope they win. So we had to make an assessment before that, though, of what kind of violence we would expect and what we'd anticipate, how much violence we'd have to deal with, and what kind of help we needed to come in there, bring in, you know, federal help, whatever. But it didn't work that way. It didn't work that way. The point is, when they won the land, and what they did was, I think they leased out one-third, sold one-third, and rented one-third. But if you went there now, you'd see it's beautiful. The Indian the Indian grounds in Old Town. And also what happened up there was there were, you know, a lot of drinking and so forth up there in Old Town. And the point is that the chief I finally got to help fired all of the cops up there. There was about six or seven. Fired them all because they were supposedly, I don't want to be quoted, but they were supposedly had keys to some of the businesses, you know, and all of that, and they were helping themselves. So this chief that I was with, I gave him support, you know, working to try to correct that. And but you see, it's relationship, because now a lot of times there might be another chief there that he wouldn't give a damn. But this chief, the one I knew, and we got to talking, and I was with civil rights, I mean, you know, and race relations, but most of the chiefs didn't want to hear that. But what happened was with this chief, we get to talking and he was about race relations and color and so. And he said, yeah, my wife, he said that my wife was pregnant and she had a baby. And she asked the doctor, you know, about the baby. And he said, it's a healthy child. She said, is it black? Now, these were Finnish. She was Finnish cops and family up there. But he was explaining to me the difference between the Occidental, you know, like the Chinese, not the Chinese, but that group, and then the other group, Scandinavian thing.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Laplanders, and the other ones. And one of them represented the dark hair, the darkness, and one of the lighter. So what I'm saying, we got to talking about that. That established a bond, a community relation bond. Another chief in the other part of the town. He told me that he was on duty one day chasing the suspect. And he got there, And he finally caught the suspect. It was a 13-year-old boy. And he said he almost killed him. He had his gun out and everything else. And from then on, police community relations was one of the things that he put up front and included that. And he always made the approach from police community relations more rather than from the weapon. But you see, the thing is, what I'm saying, part of this job is understanding who you got to work with. And there's always something in who you got to work with that enables you to establish a bond because we're all in the same boat. All in the same boat. And then there's others that, but everyone that I know, most of them, there's something about their experience, their life, that they regret, and they wish that it was different. And they feel the feel part as well as the objective part as an officer. And it's the balance between those two, the politic and the spirit.
Well, we have to thank you very much for this inspirational presentation. I enjoyed listening to your theory and finding out some of the aspects of your life's work, and
thank you.
Know that you're continuing. I think that we would like again to thank you for being
no,
here.
No, I thank you. If it's helpful to you.
So thank you again.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by former Justice Department official Edward D. McClure. Mr. McClure's lecture was titled Freckles Think Peace Pieces, Police Community Relations, A Search for Common Ground. The lecture was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was Linda Haywood, director of the African American Studies Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.